So spending some time at the beginning of meditation, just paying attention to your posture and settling into something that's comfortable, where your spine is upright, not overly tense or so relaxed that your chest is caved in and your shoulders hanging down. So that erect posture is really helpful for creating a sense of stability, a quality of centeredness, and also relaxed alertness. It allows the energy of the body to also support the energy in the mind. And at first, very deliberately giving your attention to the body, because our attention is so used to just following the ongoing thoughts, the ongoing stream of thinking mind. So when we sit meditation, the tendency is just to pick up where we left off after the chanting, maybe thinking about what we've just been doing, thinking about tomorrow, or thinking about something that's been occupying the mind recently. So deliberately sending your attention to the body to be aware of physicality, aware of the heaviness of the body. Feel the weight of the body. Feel the pressure that's perceived, whether the buttock is sitting on the cushion or the chair. This is the power of gravity that keeps the body pinned to the earth. And we feel that through this experience of pressure or weight, and also a sense of solidity. Something that we take so for granted, yet it's the most common experience on the physical level is weight, solidity, sense of pressure. So we can know the body through this quality of what we call the earth element, manifestation of earth element. And let the perception of earth element allow your mind to ground, to find a sense of centeredness, of being earthed, being aware of the earth element in the bodily posture. It changes the location of our attention. It allows our attention to settle into physicality, to come out of the mental realm. And as we settle and feel the body in this way, we quite naturally become aware of the breath that is moving in and out of this body. As we're aware of the posture, the weight of the body, we feel the rhythm of the in-breath and the out-breath. So spend a little time just being interested in how the air element of the in and out breath intermingles with the earth element of the body, the sense of solidity, of weight. And notice that the body breathes all by itself. And see if you can relax your awareness just in a quality of observing, not trying to make things one way or the other, but just noticing this kind of curious knowing, curious noticing of this body that breathes all by itself. Drawing the air element that is external to this body, drawing it in to the lungs. And the body uses the nutrient from the oxygen, probably other nutrients, I don't know my science, probably nitrogen, hydrogen, some level, but mostly the oxygen, takes it into the body, feeds the body, feeds the blood, and expels the spent air. All in a matter of a couple of seconds. And it does this without our need to tell it to, our need to force it. So it's a perfect object for our attention to cultivate in terms of mindfulness, in terms of being an object of meditation. It's here, it's present. It's an automatic process, an autonomous process. So we can train the mind, train our conscious mind, to dwell in awareness of it, observing, mindfully observing. And there will be different thoughts coming and going. So at first it's about just seeing if you can let them just recede into the background. So maybe they capture some of your attention. But if we're interested enough in the breath, in observing the breath as an object, then our attention will gather around that. And what we're actually observing here is a stream of sensations. The breath, in fact, isn't just one thing that we can get a hold of. We know the breath through a stream of sensations, a cascade of sensation, as the body draws in the breath, as body draws in air. We cognize that process through the sensation felt in the body, different parts of the body, the air touching the nostrils, inflating the chest, inflating the diaphragm, filling the lungs, and in the exhalation, the expelling of the air. It's a different cascade of sensations, and this is what we label as breath. So there's no one thing our attention can get a hold of, It's really being willing just to follow, like we follow a guide who's walking just ahead of us through the forest. It's anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing, is learning to follow this cascade of sensations connected with the in and out breath. Follow with our attention, moment by moment. So the attention needs to be directed, yet light. Not trying to grab a hold of, not forceful, but just following. Following along. Willingness just to stay on the heel of the guide walking ahead of us in the forest. Just so we cultivate this willingness to be aware of the breath, the sensations as the breath moves in, out of the body. Let any thoughts just continue to be in the background, to recede ever more into the distance, like leaving behind the chattering of a village market, and you're walking into the forest with the breath, the guide. And you feel the stillness of the forest in relation to the chattering market, the chattering mind. And you feel the simplicity of the perception, just this simple experience of in and out breath. Let it be simple, let it be peaceful. And let it be enjoyable to relax into the simplicity of that. and other sense impressions will present to the mind, whether they're thoughts arising in consciousness, sounds, other sensations of the body. So we cultivate a mind of awareness that knows what's arising, that knows what's present, and also the ability to let it be or let it go, to not jump on the bandwagon of the thoughts or get overly reactive to sensation or memory, but to just know it arising in the mind, but also ceasing in the mind. So the breath can be similar, awareness of the breath can be similar to an anchor that's dropped from the boat in the ocean. Awareness of the breath can keep you centered, can keep you still, can keep you anchored, keep you connected to nowness, presence, connected to body, even as we're buffeted by other sense impressions, as a boat in the ocean may be buffeted by the swell of the ocean. It's safe and secure with its anchor dropped. So even if we lose mindfulness of breath for a few seconds, a few minutes, it's always there to be reconnected with. Just have to remember the breath, the body. And instantly the thoughts that have hijacked our attention are dispelled with that mindful recognition of here and now, of body and breath. So we keep doing this, we keep practicing this way. Recognizing if tension arises, then we learn to relax. If sleepiness arises, we learn to bring a bit more energy, a bit more alertness. So staying interested in the meditation. And we can do that by recognizing if there's anywhere in the body that would feel that we feel tension. And just seeing if we can relax that very gently, very kindly. Noticing if there's any particular mind state or emotion that's present. If it's painful or if it's unpleasant or pleasant, just noticing the quality of that. The feeling tone of the mind state. Noticing if we're clinging to anything, clinging to an idea, a perception, caught in not wanting a particular mind state or mood or sensation. Notice the quality, the feeling tone of that clinging, the pushing or the pulling. And see, explore if there's a way to release that clinging, to let go, to let be, to open, to relax. So why do we meditate? Who knows? Why do we meditate? Any thoughts? Ideas?
To like release stress.
To release stress, that's one potential outcome of meditation. That's right. To release stress. In fact, that statement can go all the way through to release stress, not just the daily stresses of the body and mind, but in terms of stress, which is dukkha, the Buddha points to the dukkha that seems to follow us and cycle with us in samsara. Certainly that's the aim of the Buddha's teaching, is to help free beings from stress, or help them free themselves from stress. Yeah. So this stress goes quite deep. And I guess for all of us, it doesn't take long to realize that when we sit down and watch the mind. We can see how deep the various stresses go, whether it's just the accumulated stress of our day-to-day living. You know, this body gets tired and the mind gets tired. We have emotional reactivity, and this is... These are kind of stresses on the body and the mind. And then just looking into why there is stress, looking into why there is unhappiness, why there is confusion, why there is this sense of unsatisfactoriness. It's another translation of the word dukkha. And how at many levels it's present, it expresses itself in many ways. This is what the Buddha's pointing to, this experience of stress. That's the translation of dukkha by Tanisara Bhikkhu. It's quite a good capturing of this quality of dukkha. But many people will use meditation as they use the yoga or other activity just to take off the edge of the stress of everyday living, which is a worthwhile thing to do. But the Buddha's not just pointing to this everyday stress, he's pointing to the chronic stress of beings caught in this cycle of endless wandering with the experience of dukkha, not being able to find their way out of the various levels of stress. So the Buddha and other spiritual seekers before him, searching for the antidote, if you like, searching for the way out. And I think for all of us, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I guess for all of us as spiritual beings, I guess we wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be practicing this path if we didn't really intuit for ourselves that peace was possible, that freedom from stress, freedom from dukkha was possible, that the Buddha was pointing, that there's a very message of the Buddha. He wouldn't have taught if it weren't for the fact that he discovered it is possible to find the complete freedom from stress, freedom from suffering, to undermine and come out of this sense of confusion or delusion through fully understanding stress and its causes and the way to move beyond, or the way to allow that stress to come to cessation. So it's a worthy thing to follow up on. And of course, meditation forms a very large part of the Buddha's path to understanding stress, to finding our way to freedom from stress. And although we've perhaps tried to do that all our lives, all beings are trying to get away from pain, aren't they? Trying to get away from discomfort, despair, difficulty, confusion. But what the kind of originality of the way the Buddha articulated his teaching was recognizing that all beings indeed wanted to find freedom from suffering and sought it in many ways. But the fact that we haven't understood suffering, we haven't understood this experience of stress, we haven't really comprehended it, we haven't apprehended it fully to the point where we really understand it. He said that is why we're not able to be free of it, because we haven't actually understood it. We haven't understood its manifestation, we haven't understood how it arises in the body-mind. And no matter how much we wish to get away from it and how much we try to get away from it through various means, unless we really apprehend what that experience is, comprehend it, understand it, the Buddha was saying we won't actually find that freedom from suffering. So this means that we have to really have a good look at this experience of dukkha, this experience of stress, which is difficult in itself because so much of our mind wants to get away from it. So, you know, so much of our conditioning is to move away from pain, to move away from stress. So automatically and almost unconsciously. And this kind of feeds the mind that perpetually travels into the future in our imagination, building, you know, our perfect future, our ideal future. And often all of that happens just because this mind is trying to get away from what it feels as stressful in the present. Yeah? The mind can create so much movement and spinning, even unconsciously, just because it's conditioned to try and get away from something that's felt as unpleasant. So this is one of the first things we have to really wake up to as we observe what's happening in this body-mind. We observe, and it's a very natural tendency to move away from pain, to move away from discomfort, to move away from stress. It's very natural. I'm not saying it's wrong. But we have to actually start to bring awareness to that event, to bring awareness to that experience in the heart. Because if we don't, we're going to miss these truths of dukkha, its cause and its cessation and the path. So the Four Noble Truths lie very close to apprehending this experience of dukkha. Really being, learning how to be present with it, not to the degree that we become masochistic, you know, we're really forcing ourselves to bear with a lot of pain, but intelligently so, being willing to look, and not even to have to, you know, force yourself to be with the really difficult stuff, but we can learn so much from just those little stresses when we sit and observe this body and mind. There's so much that's going on. There's pleasant and painful feeling perpetually happening in consciousness. And when we have a memory, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling tone. When we experience a sensation in the body, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or anywhere along that spectrum. When we experience a thought, an idea, usually we know that we like it or we don't like it. We know a sensation, I like it or I don't like it. But just prior to the liking and the not liking is this feeling tone of unpleasant or pleasant. We generally like and want the pleasant, and we generally are conditioned to push away and to resist and get away from the unpleasant. Yeah? So what we need to do is bring more and more awareness to the underlying feeling tone of our likes and our dislikes. Yeah? When we become aware that we want something or we don't want something, training our attention to recognize what is that happening in relation to. you know, an unpleasant or pleasant thought, an unpleasant or pleasant sensation, unpleasant or pleasant idea, experience. So when we start to look into that territory, it can be very interesting, because now we're looking into this territory of dependent origination, which was the Buddha called the law of conditionality. And what he understood on the night of his awakening is these causal links, is how dukkha arises in the present depending on these causal links. And feeling tone arising on sense contact is right in the middle of that chain of causal events, but this is where we can really observe it happening in our own body and our own mind. So ignorance, what's called avijja, is the first component at the beginning of that paticca samuppada. You know, dukkha, the last component, the arising of dukkha, is dependent on avijja, or ignorance, or not knowing, or unawareness, or ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha always arises when there's ignorance. When there's no ignorance, no dukkha can arise. So when we can clarify, when we start to understand these Four Noble Truths to the point that avijja, ignorance, is dispelled, dukkha can no longer arise, because that's its causal factor. It can only arise independent on ignorance. However, in the middle of this chain of causal events, we've got sense contact giving rise to feeling tone, and feeling tone giving rise to tanha, or craving. So these three links are primary territory for us, because we can observe these links. It's kind of pretty hard to observe ignorance, you know, because it's like this all-pervasive, it's like an all-pervasive experience.
Soup.
Yeah. You know, that with some fine awareness, one can actually observe, you know, the effect of ignorance or unawareness or losing of awareness, you know. We can observe some aspect of that, but generally it's pretty hard. What we can observe, and what the Buddha is telling us in many of his suttas, is to become familiar with sense contact. That is, when we experience something at any of the sense doors, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, tactile sensation through the body, and thinking or thoughts or mental notions that arise at the mind door. There's the sixth sense. So this we can be directly aware of, or we can train our attention, our awareness, to become more mindful, more aware of when seeing, when hearing an object, when hearing a sound, when tasting, a food or a drink, when the sensations in the body coming into contact, that pressure that I mentioned in the meditation, we become aware of the pressure of the body against the cushion or the chair. That's a sense contact at the door of the body sense, the body organ. It's felt through sensation. So consciousness of that, awareness of that, as a moment of sense consciousness. With each moment of sense consciousness, the Buddha says, there is an accompanying feeling tone, vedana. There is a vedana, accompanying feeling tone in each moment of sense consciousness. Now this we're not used to identifying, we're not used to becoming aware of, but it's actually really helpful, really important to become aware of it, because samsara spins out of this. Our samsara of running towards the pleasant or running away from the unpleasant in subtle and more obvious ways, it all comes out of the vedana and the sense contact. So to begin to observe this, not to be afraid to observe craving arising and running towards the pleasant, not to be afraid to observe the aversion arising and running away from the painful. Because this is where we can get tripped up as meditators, as idealistic meditators. We try to be perfect, we try to be a Buddha before we've really walked the path, yeah? And then we'll get upset at with ourselves if we see ourselves frightened of the painful or longing for the pleasant or getting averse or becoming hooked into sense desire. So don't get down on yourselves for seeing this, but get interested. Get interested in what's happening here, what's capturing my attention, what's giving rise to fear, what's giving rise to this longing that I just can't exist without another piece of toast or whatever it is where you observe the sense desire arising. I can't bear to have breakfast without a perfect cup of tea, you know, and the effort you put into making the perfect cup of tea, to get interested in that, not like, oh, I'm so attached to my perfect cup of tea, I'm so bad, I need to relinquish, get, you know, give it up, but actually get interested. So what's dependent on this, you know, fill in your own favorite food or favorite drink. What is it that's dependent on getting it the way I want it? What is it that I'm experiencing in the mind that's telling me, oh, I must have it this way and not that way? This kind of sense of desire and fear, or fear and hope, desire and aversion, or the disappointment, even in little ways, when we don't quite get it right, or something isn't as tasty as it should have been, you know. All these little ways we can observe how the push-pull effect, the desire, the wanting, the not wanting, arises out of the experience of a sense contact that is felt as either pleasant or unpleasant. These are the easiest ones to observe, the pleasant or the unpleasant. Neutral is a bit harder to observe because we're so uninterested in the neutral, because it's not making much of an impact. But in fact, the neutral feeling tone is where ignorance can hide. You know, we kind of dull out. We're actually more interested in that which is painful or pleasant through either aversion or desire. So getting interested in this territory is the territory of insight. It is where stress arises in our reactivity to either the pleasant or the painful, our judgment of the pleasant or the painful. And until we can observe this clearly and start to understand how desire, fear, aversion arises out of this experience, we won't be able to free ourselves from dukkha. We'll still just be caught up in the running, spinning. So as I was saying earlier today in the lunchtime reflection, you know, from this kind of observing of, you know, the natural desire for the pleasant and the natural kind of wanting to move away from the unpleasant, we might conceive that I have to learn how to bear with the unpleasant and relinquish everything that I want in relation to the pleasant. This is what the mind conceives of, right? And you think, oh, what a difficult path this is to walk. You know, how can I do that? How can I become a superman, a superwoman, a superhuman, you know, and bear with everything unpleasant without fear, without hesitation, and relinquish everything that is pleasant? You know, that's how we can think, right? Now, while the Buddha did encourage patient endurance when we are in the face of having to bear with pain and difficulty that we can't dispel, then yes, learning how to be patient and endure difficulties until they change, which they do eventually, that's a wholesome thing to do. And learning how to cultivate relinquishment where possible, renunciation where possible, giving, generosity where possible, this is also very wholesome. But this in itself is not necessarily that which leads to the cessation of dukkha. The insight into the nature of reality is what leads to the cessation of dukkha. The fact that pleasant, neutral and unpleasant feeling arises and ceases, to see this clearly, to see that it arises and ceases in dependence on a momentary sense contact that arises and ceases. Seeing into this true nature of the mind, the true nature of feeling tone, of sense contact, and even of this experience of craving, of wanting and not wanting that arises out of sense contact and feeling tone, it also is anicca. It appears for a moment and then disappears. To see this clearly is the manifestation of wisdom which can cut through identification, which cuts through clinging. Not the trying to become someone who doesn't cling, or the trying to be someone who is not fearful. It's seeing the nature of this causal conditioned process as anicca, as arising in a dependent process. When we see that clearly, we see it's anicca, it's dukkha, and it's anatta aspect. Seeing those aspects clearly is what releases the heart, is where we understand that this dukkha that arises only arises through identification and clinging to these conditionally arisen experiences. Yeah? When we fully identify with that, then we're caught into the spin, we're caught into the push-pull, and then we struggle to get out of it from this place of identification. But if you cultivate this awareness to the point that awareness sees clearly these experiences arising and ceasing, the clinging is already abandoned, the clinging is released, or it does not even arise in the first place. If one sees this territory of feeling tone arising dependent on sense contact, and even if craving arises dependent on that feeling, when that feeling ceases, that craving ceases. But if we don't see it, it moves into clinging, to becoming, to birth, to old age, sickness, death, dukkha. It continues the round. It lays more seeds for the round. It lays the tendency for more of the same when we don't see it. So this is why such importance is laid on the insight. We cultivate a degree of calm in our meditation practice in order to support the clarity which elicits insight, the clarity which is in full presence to see, to witness the arising, ceasing nature of sense contact, of sense impression. Even if we see that clearly, the accompanying feeling tone will arise and cease. And with its cessation, we see it's not me, it's not mine, it's not what I am. This is an expression of anatta. Not me, not mine, not what I am. But this is these instructions are practice instructions. You know, if we leave it just like that, we think, well, what does that mean? How does that help us? It only helps us if we're able to cultivate that presence, that clarity in the moment, in our practice, to see these phenomena arising and ceasing clearly for ourselves. So I mentioned earlier today, the more we're able to settle the mind, even to some degree, it starts to separate out. Usually we experience awareness quite merged with our sense experience, yeah? But the more we cultivate mindfulness, awareness, this knowing quality in stillness of meditation, but also in activity, it starts to develop more of a prominence. And you experience, I'm not sure if these are the right words technically, but one can experience a separating out where awareness becomes more prominent and it can more clearly observe the arising and ceasing of sense impression. So if that is observed, sense impressions are observed, and even feeling tones observed, now pleasant, something is pleasant, it arises, ceases. If it's not grasped at, that which knows this experience knows that it's not involved in that experience, it's observed it. There's a residual impression, but the awareness remains constant. So this is where the insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta can arise. And that's, as I mentioned, these are the insights that release the mind. These are the insights that cut through clinging and craving and undermine ignorance. And that can come about quite naturally in this cultivation of awareness, this cultivation of mindfulness. But we have to learn to trust that process, don't we? We have to learn to trust in this quality of awareness, this inherent awareness, to learn to rest there in our meditative experience, but also in our day-to-day experience. And only if we walk this path do we really understand the benefits it brings, the clarity that it can bring, and the ensuing peace of that understanding. It doesn't mean, even with some insight, it doesn't cut away ignorance altogether, but it can clarify what the path of practice is. And as I was saying a little bit earlier, in relation to this quality of ignorance, or that's one translation, avijja. Avijja can mean knowing, particularly the knowing and awareness of the insights into the Four Noble Truths. So the kind of knowing that is clear about the experience of dukkha, of when it arises, of how it arises, but also how it ceases, how it disappears when there's no clinging. So that's the kind of awareness in its fullness which undermines avijja, not knowing or not seeing or ignorance of the truth. But sometimes I can observe, like sometimes you can observe, even as you're establishing awareness and there's some clarity, sometimes you can observe how that awareness gets hindered, almost as if it gets something turns awareness away, like when we get pulled into a stream of thinking. It's like suddenly we're, no, I'm really interested more in this particular idea, or you know, whatever we're getting involved in our thinking. And we kind of lose awareness. There's a degree of awareness that keeps moving with the thinking. But then when we wake up to say, thinking, then we re-establish this awareness. So you can even look at that movement in meditation of, say, losing the clarity of awareness through getting absorbed into thinking for a while, and then re-establishing that clarity. Just getting to know what that feels like and how that process comes about through remembering, through recollecting, through recognizing awareness is always present, yeah, but sometimes it's merged with this sense experience which travels rather than sitting still like that dropped anchor. So we can access this path of practice, you know, in any moment of our experience, any moment of our daily waking experience. The other, let's say, the other skill of using these Four Noble Truths as a framework for the path, as a framework of awakening, dukkha is being the first sign to wake up, because there are so many times during the day where we come up against this experience of dukkha, experience of stress, unsatisfactoriness, slight despondency or disappointment, or just all the various unpleasant things that we come into contact with on a daily basis. We can wake up when we experience this dukkha, rather than just feel resigned to it, or to struggle with it, or think it's my fault, or think it's someone else's fault. If we could just get things right in the home or the workplace or the world or with the government, you know, and this sense of things aren't quite right, you know, but actually wake up and say, hang on, this is an experience of dukkha. This is the experience of the First Noble Truth. And establishing that awareness of dukkha, of that truth as a reality, right there is the path, has constellated, the path of liberation has constellated in that moment of recognizing this First Noble Truth, dukkha. But when we lose awareness, you know, we get into our old patterns, and they all have some kind of measure of struggle or trying to adjust or become comfortable with this, that or the other. But as soon as we recognize dukkha, it's like, ah. Seeing that First Noble Truth already releases the stress associated with full identification with that experience of dukkha, or in opposition to that experience of dukkha. Waking up is waking up out of it and establishing refuge in knowing it just as it is. And as we observe it, it shows us the truth of anicca. Soon as we observe something with that clarity, we see it changes. It's dependently arisen. And it's really only in our grasping and our identification and our struggle with these things that the dukkha is perpetuated, through not having full awareness, not having full understanding. As soon as we snap out of it and recognize, this is the First Noble Truth, we again have that right view and perspective. And the mind then is poised, awareness is poised to really penetrate these truths, depending on our cultivation, depending on the strength of that awareness and the strength of the wisdom faculty. So these are just a few words about the practice path that we're all engaged in, and I hope they've been helpful in some way, and thank you for your response, because that helped.